thank you for coming to this session entitled The Future of Universal Access, Part 1. Just so you all know, this is really a two-part session. In the next hour and a half, we are going to have a discussion about the past and the present of universal access. And to do that, we have four distinguished guests, speakers, who I will introduce you to in a minute. After we've discussed the past and present of universal access, there will be another session that starts at 4:30 this afternoon that will discuss the future of the idea of universal access. And the way these two sessions have been put together is that they are intended to complement and to build on each other. So I would appeal to people in this session to please try and stay for the session that will begin at 4:30 under the moderatorship of Stephen Lewis. We're fortunate today, I made a joke before we started, but to help us have this deliberation, we have four activists. An activist, Kieran Daly, from the International Council of AIDS Service Organizations. An activist doctor, Dr. Peter Mugyeni from Uganda, a doctor who has been with us in this epidemic, in trying to challenge this epidemic and get treatment to people for very, very many years, and who has been very influential in shaping the global and the African response to HIV. An activist economist in the form of Professor Nicolene Natras from the University of Cape Town. There's claps for Nikki. An economist who pursues the science of economics but does a lot to make economics accessible and economic argument available to justify human rights and to justify the very principles that underlie the notion of universal access. And finally, an activist priest, Reverend Robert Vitillo from Caritas International. Caritas International is a Catholic church-based organization that provides medical services, treatment services to many, many thousands, tens of thousands of people across the world. So we have four different perspectives that we are going to bring to bear on this discussion. The way we're going to structure the discussion is that I'm going to ask a number of questions to each of the people that we have with us, and then we're going to try and pick up some of the threads, some of the issues, some of the debates that are currently raging around universal access. Universal access seems to be a theme of this conference. Many of the presentations, many of the sessions use the term universal access. But I often wonder whether or how many people know what we're actually talking about. What is this strange fish called universal access? If we know what we're talking about in this room, does the world know what we're talking about when we talk about universal access? And why is universal access necessary when it comes to HIV? After all, poor people around the world don't have universal access to other medicines and to other treatments. They don't have universal access to malaria treatment. They don't have universal access to antenatal services. So why should we exceptionalize HIV and have universal access to HIV prevention and treatment services? So let's dig a little bit into this idea of universal access. And let's start with Dr. Mugyeni from Uganda, who, as I said a few minutes ago, is a practicing clinician. And I want Dr. Mugyeni to explain to you, to explain to us, where did this thing come from? And why, from his experience as a doctor in one of our countries from Africa, was it important to deal with the HIV epidemic? Dr. Mugyeni, you've got 5 or 6 minutes to convince our audience, and then we will bring another perspective to bear on this discussion. Thank you very much.
Should I stand up?
Please, you can sit down or stand up, whichever you're most comfortable with.
Thank you, Chair, for giving this opportunity to share with the audience the experience we've had with HIV/AIDS. Well, I would like to start by taking you back. The reason why I would like to take you back is that, regrettably, memories are beginning to fade. The reason why memories are fading is perhaps not surprising. People like to forget unpleasant things, and they like the pleasant things to stay. That's how hope builds in us. But perhaps what happened in the case of HIV/AIDS should never fade from our memories. I take you back to early 1990s. It was a bleak situation, particularly in Africa, the continent where I come from. Africa was not alone. There wasn't much that could be done for HIV/AIDS. There was no treatment. But a revolution took place in 1995-1996, where for the first time, the most effective treatment for HIV became available. Then from there onwards, the world was divided in two. We had the world which would access this life-saving treatment, and we had a world which could not. And this constituted what was described at the time as a moral and ethical dilemma. That was back in 1996. As treatment became more and more effective, as demonstrated by response of patients, there were such flamboyant words that came to describe the magic of these drugs, one of which was called Lazarus syndrome. People giving up for the dead, resurrecting as a result of antiretroviral therapy. Meantime, in Africa and resource-constrained countries, who could not afford the miracle that had become the HIV, remained in a dire situation. Not only did they remain in a dire situation, the numbers were increasing. The carnage became a crisis. It could no longer be swept under the carpet. It indeed constituted a moral imperative for the rich countries to watch and do nothing as millions of people were decimated. The turning point came in around that time, 1996. The leaders of the G8 met, that famous meeting, and they declared that the world should start moving towards universal access. And this is perhaps when this word started coming in. Since then, universal access has been getting different descriptions depending on people's conception, but mostly depending on people trying to give an excuse for an objective that is noble. That's universal access. It's not very difficult language. Universal and access are self-explanatory, but people started saying, of this universal access, we could do this. Anyway, the leaders of the G8 dedicated themselves to universal access. And they set a timetable. The timetable was by the year 2010. That is last year. And they didn't go with that alone. There were other ambitious goals set, the millennium goals for health. These were noble objectives. They remain noble objectives, But we are where we are right now because we all know we didn't achieve those missed targets. But these missed targets could now be reactivated to move us to another level. Now, another turning point in universal access came in 2003 when Seriously 2 programs started taking effect. These two programs was the groundbreaking PEPFAR program and the Global Fund for HIV/AIDS. These two programs made my country, Uganda, and most other countries, developing countries, do for the first time what up to that point had been described as impossible in Africa. Excuses has been the theme. At that time, it was said Africa could not have antiretroviral therapy because of the various challenges which could not, quote, be overcome. One guy, famous fellow, made a statement. Actually, I remember two statements which are very, very critical. But one of them was that Africa cannot do antiretroviral therapy. They require precision timing. Africans have no watches. If the sun doesn't come out that day, they wouldn't know how to take their drugs. Another one had a worse comment, and I remember it vividly. It was that if antiretroviral therapy, he was trying to justify why Africa could not access treatment, that if antiretroviral therapy was a glass of water, Africa could not afford it. Anyway, the impossible happened. What we had all the time been staring the world was that we have a crisis in Africa, a continent with least resources, but if we could get the resources to treat the people, would be able to treat them without much problem, would be able to scale up treatment, and would be able to save lives. That's precisely what happened. If I take the example of my organization, the Joint Clinical Research Center, when funds from PEPFAR became available, it was thought within a year would be able to put 5,000 new patients on treatment. That's just my organization. Within that same year, we put close to 28,000 patients on treatment as one single organization. And this has been repeated in many other countries across Africa. And some of them are approaching record numbers, like Botswana, which has the resources. South Africa, if you are here this morning, the Minister of Health of South Africa is talking a different language from the previous minister. And South Africa now has 1 million people on treatment. But I'm going to close my introductory remark by bringing you to the present. The present is a very critical time. Once again, we are facing some of those prospects which we faced in the mid-1990s. We are beginning to hear a language which I thought would not hear about. And this is the language of money once more. It is too expensive. We can't do it. We are beginning to see people doing the soft options. They know what needs to be done. It is universal access. And they are now saying, we are now going back to the time when some people are now once more saying, we need to choose what we need to do, which what we can afford. They are not saying what we should all be saying, that at this critical time, we have more scientific advances. These scientific advances are quite impressive. part of which we know we can treat everybody. Secondly, we know treatment is not merely treatment. Treatment can be used as part and parcel of other preventive armaments that we have now. We have exciting new drugs, and research continues, and some scientists now are talking even about finding a cure in the future, but starting by doing the science today. So this is the critical time which we face now, and as we face it, we need to know that this is not the first time these kind of issues of things being impossible have arisen. And this is the kind of time that we once again need to rise up and be able to say, we can do it, and we need to get commitment, not only of ourselves, because here I'm talking to the converted, but we need commitment of our governments, we need commitment of the international community, and we call upon the leadership of rich countries once more to know that an emergency has not gone away. We have a financial crunch, and it has been solved by increasing resources. It is being solved by increasing resources, and AIDS, more than anything else, requires that resources be increased so that we can continue on the move towards solving this century's most devastating health problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mogyeni. I understand from what you're saying that universal access is a moral imperative. I understand that maybe it's a human right. I can understand your perspective as a doctor, your desire to keep people alive, to keep people healthy. But the world doesn't work on moral imperatives. The world works on politics. And it doesn't seem like universal access was ever a political imperative. And one of the questions I'd like Kieran from ICASO, the International Council of AIDS Service Organizations, to take us forward from what you've said is to explain, how was it ever a political imperative? You lobbied for this, Kieran. Did you lobby for the right thing? Did you think about what you were lobbying for? Did you lobby for a concept that means anything? What does universal access mean? It sounds wishy-washy to me. How do we measure it? But most of all, how do you get the political will that is necessary to help us to achieve Dr. Mogyeni's ideals? Kieran Daly from ICASO, please enlighten us.
Thanks, Mark. And I'll stay sitting down, but I think it's funny the way you ask the question as if it's not a political imperative, because the irony is it was meant to be. And Dr. Mogyeni talked about the G8 committing to universal access by 2010 in 2005. Then again, universal access commitments, not only to treatment, to prevention, care and support in the universal, the UNGAS, UN General Assembly, and the political declaration that came out of that, which you're right, many activists were out there pushing for that political commitment from governments around the world. And it is very much, I agree with your point, it isn't a political imperative. It was words on the paper. It was, we were pushing for something. There was mobilization, and there was, you know, the success of ramping up treatment to the level it was. It wasn't anywhere near what we wanted in 2005, 2006. But there was political momentum coming from many different countries. And even the G8 and other commitments came from some of the big governments and influential governments saying, yes, we're going to commit to universal access, but no definition. And I think this is why in 2010, right now, we're nowhere near achieving universal access. And I would say universal access being about access to the quality services for all those that need them. And it's not necessarily about everyone getting everything. It's really about those that need the HIV prevention, treatment, care and support services to access them. Now, this political leadership has certainly waned, and we're in a environment right now where AIDS is on the wane within the donor and maybe national government commitments. But also it seems that the momentum for pushing and a leadership for pushing for real universal access, as we may understand it, is lacking as well. So the process was, following the 2006 political declaration, within that there was a commitment for the UN system to work with national governments to come up with ambitious targets for universal access. They were to define it themselves, and country-driven processes that made sense to actually set targets, ambitious targets. But when there was no definition, I suggested a definition just now, but there was really no definition. So it was really out there for anyone to come up with what they thought. And UNAIDS were there to support that at the country level. And in 2007, my own organization, ICASU, did some analysis, but many other organizations did analysis on what those targets looked like. And what came back was very clearly that many governments not only were defining universal access essentially as a little slow increment on their AIDS programming, but also that it was acceptable to exclude many of the populations that actually needed the services. So, you know, who would say a target of 0% access to services for sex workers or people who use drugs as a target? I.e., they didn't set targets for some of the most vulnerable populations in an epidemic in Eastern Europe, for example, where there's no commitment, no targets for harm reduction, needle exchange, opiate substitution therapy. That's not universal access, and that's some of the most blindingly obvious issues. So it's this lack of direction in universal access in terms of what the political leaders saw it as, but also that lack of support by the technical agencies that were meant to be helping governments, you know, drive towards a more comprehensive access to services. And the interesting thing is, I know you just want some introductions here, but the interesting thing is that we had a discussion yesterday, we had a little session, and we titled it, Fool Me Once, Shame on You, Fool Me Twice, Shame on Me. And I think it is that we got sucked into pushing and advocating, activists around the world pushing for universal access, and we were fooled by the commitments put on paper by governments that they actually meaningfully thought universal access was achievable in 2010. So we're now in a situation, and I know we're not looking forward, but we're now in a situation where we're now talking about 2015. But until we look back at what happened and why we failed to achieve it in 2010, because of that lack of clarity on what universal access meant and that lack of leadership, and what I put on top of that, and Peter talked about a little bit, the lack of any kind of financial strategy for achieving universal access. There was no commitment to the money, and we're now facing that right now, because now we're struggling to get money for the Global Fund, we're struggling to increase PEPFAR, we're struggling to get the money. And that's because there was no financial strategy in the first place for us to understand how much money really was needed to achieve universal access. Thank you.
Thanks, Kieran. Thank you very much. Maybe we can ask a question a little bit later and ask Kieran to perhaps think about this for a few minutes, about whether it's too late to properly define what we mean by universal access, and to then hold the world and the world's political leaders to a definition that we determine, and a reasonable definition of universal access. Maybe another thing that we should think about, as you say, we shouldn't be fooled twice, is that we should perhaps look at costing universal access rather than waiting for governments to cost universal access. But that brings us to our third speaker this afternoon, Nikki Natras. And Nikki, I want you to try to answer whether universal access was ever realistic from an economic point of view. I mean, Dr. Mogherini said universal access is a moral imperative, but does that make it an economic imperative? He said that at one point people said if ARVs was a glass of water, Africa couldn't afford it. Well, you know, so can we afford universal access? And help us with this, because I remember an old Russian revolutionary who said politics is concentrated economics. And if we don't understand the economics of universal access, we'll never get to the bottom of the politics. So, fill us in, please.
Yeah, I guess that's the million-dollar question. I mean, if we had to look back at the past, what's really striking is the incredible increase in money for AIDS that happened in the 2000s. You know, we went pretty much from, you know, less than a billion at the turn of the century to 10 billion a year by 2007 or so. And that was a dramatic upscale. And that seems to have been driven by political commitments. Clearly, I think there were a couple of big political victories that were won by the activist community. One of them was, I think, certainly Peter Piot convincing the UN that it was a human security issue. And the other one was global activism across nations that seemed to be putting pressure on countries around the globe. And then, fortunately for us, it kind of fitted into George Bush's conservative care agenda, and he went running with this notion with PEPFAR. And I think PEPFAR, like you were saying, plus the Global Fund 2003-04, really injected a lot of momentum. Now, we know that history. The question for me is, why did that happen? I mean, you can say, yes, there was the political will, and it was, we were lucky that these arguments were won. But I think what was really behind it was that we were in the middle of the longest boom in capitalism since the post-war, the early post-war period. It's now, the economists look back on this and say this was the great moderation. We sustained growth everywhere. Even Africa was growing strongly. Gordon Brown, the old head of the UK, the Prime Minister, was basically saying, the business cycle's gone. You know, we've dead. We can move beyond this. There was this notion that somehow growth would just keep rising, there'd be sustained rise in productivity and profitability, and we could actually fund a whole lot of human rights things. Now that, I think, was the reason why we got that commitment to universal access, even though it wasn't properly defined and was left to country governments to define. And certainly by 2008-09, when we started getting that big global crash, suddenly people woke up and thought, whoa, the business cycle's back, we can't just keep expanding these commitments, and certainly we can't expect productivity to keep rising so that we can actually pay back or keep the tax dollars rising to fund that access. So that's why we've had this turn backwards from universal access, and that's why we're seeing this drop in political leadership. And what I find interesting, just looking at these big number questions, was, you know, from 2008, 7, 8, and 9, UNAIDS would come up with big numbers. So I remember the one for 2009, we need $26.5 billion. We've only got, you know, 16. We need another $7.5 billion. These are the kinds of numbers that were being thrown around, and we were kind of pushing for fund the gap. Now, when you look at the UNAIDS' outlook, there's no big numbers being tossed around. And that, I think, is interesting. No, people are not fighting for numbers at all. It's now treatment 2.0, says UNAIDS, and it's about doing more with what we've got. And I think that's something we've really got to take on board. And Clinton saying yesterday that you're very lucky. You know, PEPFAR's flatlined. That's lucky. You should be supporting the Americans for flatlining it, not for not cutting it. So it's actually, and that's quite an important thing. We've still won that victory. It's amazing in this kind of end of the great boom that we've managed to keep the AIDS funding where it is without it going down. So trying to push for more in that, I think, is kind of unrealistic at that stage because we've got the economy hitting against us. And the other thing which is interesting about this report, I just want to draw your attention to, is on page 60, I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but they say that in 25 countries, which absorbed 75% of resources for AIDS, where 85% of people are living, it's 25 countries, and of these, just under half, 12, should be able to afford it all themselves. So UNAIDS is no longer fighting for a big number. And they're saying there's a whole bunch of countries where the AIDS response only costs 0.5% of GDP, and you guys should fund it yourself. And that includes Vietnam, Pakistan, India, Ukraine, Thailand, China, Argentina, Mexico. They're all there. And the countries which are now being put forward as being the deserving countries are pretty much the African countries, most of which are in sub-Saharan Africa. So the other big challenge facing us right now, I think, is that there's a growing split between some countries being seen as more deserving for what little resources are out there. And it looks like it's kind of Africa versus the rest. And I don't think we've really come to grips with what that means for us politically and economically yet.
Thanks, Nikki. Before I let you off the hook, just a couple of questions I want you to try to respond to. The first is, surely if there's not the money, there's not the money for universal access. Do you agree that there's not the money for universal access? And secondly, is there an economic cost to giving up on universal access? I mean, is the economics only in the money that we must forward find? Or is there a cost to letting people die, to letting our hospitals start to fill up again? I mean, do you accept the arguments that are thrown out there to justify limiting these ambitions?
I still think we can get universal access, and I think it's something we can fight for, and I think it is affordable. And what I actually like about the UNAIDS approach now is it's very much on we can do things smarter and better, and that this is not just a slogan. There really are huge gains that we've made. For example, the drop in the cost of second-line treatment down to below $500. The fact that we can get a single pill out there in developing countries for under $200, I mean, a year. That's fantastic, and I think we can actually do it. And I think that nurse-driven programs and all of these innovations that are coming through in this conference can make this affordable. What I was just merely pointing to is that the kind of international push for the big number, which is somehow we add up all the global needs, and then we go to the international community, we ask for it. I think that day is over. Now the focus is very much on working smarter, and the focus is also much more at the national level, because its activists now have to ask their governments, put the money in, use these really cheap and efficient products, and get people on board. So I certainly think it can be done. I'm really heartened by South Africa. It was wonderful listening to our health minister this morning, and he was saying we can afford it and we can do it. And I think if a lot of countries can follow his lead, we're there, because in the end, universal access has to come from the national governments, supported by activism where necessary. But the days of the big number, you know, and getting it funded through huge international initiatives, I think that those days are over. They went down with the big boom from 2000.
Thank you. Maybe we'll debate that a little bit further in a few minutes, and I'm sure there's some views on that from within the audience. Father Vitilo, one of the things Nikki said was that, you know, the flatlining of PEPFAR should be seen as a victory, which brings us to the present. And I'm interested to know from your perspective as in Caritas, what flatlining actually means, and perhaps Dr. Mugyeni can also speak from the perspective of Uganda after you, that, you know, what are you seeing? Are you seeing continued growth in the numbers of people receiving treatment? Are you seeing something different? And do you perhaps as a man of the cloth or whatever have a different view as to something other than economics and politics that should perhaps condition and guide the way we frame universal access? I haven't, for example, heard anybody use the word human rights in this discussion, the human right to health. So will you just help us a little bit with these issues?
I hope that I have a view that goes beyond politics and economics, but includes that as well, because it also has to be grounded in reality. My involvement in universal access came from the ground, from visiting in Uganda many, many years ago in the 1980s, and then in many other places in the world where people, of course, were dying. Hospitals were full. I remember being in a hospital in Masaka where the patients were out in the lawn in front of the buildings because there was no longer any room when they had two adult patients to each bed. dead and there was no more room. I think many of us were involved and knew those terrible times. And then the excitement that something could happen in one part of the world, even if it was happening in the north. But then as I visited people in the southern countries and worked with them, their questions, haunting questions, why should this be where you're coming from and not in the rest of the world? Can't you take me back with you so I could get those medicines? Can you bring me some medicines the next time you come? If you can't take me back, then take my children so they have a chance to live. So I think that's what we have to remember. The dream and the hope for universal access came from the people who were suffering and who wanted to live beyond everything else. And that means that it's centered on people's human dignity and their right to have a basic standard of health. All people, not just people in one country or another or one continent or another. I was, like Kieran, I was involved in the Universal Access Task Force of UNAIDS to try to develop this framework for universal access. And I have to say that during those days, and I think Karen would probably agree with me, there wasn't a full political commitment to this. And there was great resistance, as Karen said, to have some kind of a definition or even to make it universal. I remember several governments around the table fighting that word universal and wanting to set some smaller limit. And their reason, which I found quite illogical, was there might be some people who won't want the treatment. And so if we say it's universal, then we'll be forcing them into taking this treatment. So even at that point, there was not, I felt, a full political commitment. Also, as things did begin to open up through the funding mechanisms that have already been described, then I remember the anxiety of people in the faith-based organizations throughout the world about rolling out this work. Because they said, if we take a commitment for these people, we have to be sure that we can maintain them on treatment forever. They already knew that governments might change their priorities, but they were part of the community and they were not going to abandon these people. And that great anxiety and reticence we had to work with, and now I feel guilty that I assured them that there probably would be a long-term commitment to this universal access, which now seems to be much more uncertain. So I think that as we look at the history, we have to ground it in the reality of the people. And then when we also look at the future, I hope in the next session, they'll ground it in the reality of the people and not just stay with abstract principles or political expedience. The other thing is now what's happening in the field. Well, what I'm hearing from our Catholic Church organizations, but also a wider study that was done by the Ecumenical Advocacy Alliance of the experience of many faith-based organizations involved in treatment, care, support, and prevention programs, is that certainly there's a change in priorities. Many of our people running treatment programs are being told not to take in any new clients. Some people who are already receiving medication are now no longer receiving it. Others, when a whole family comes and mother, father, and children are infected, they're being told one person from the family could come on. Now, in many cultures, that will not happen. They will get one dosage of the medication or one supply of medication, and they will share it, and then no one from that family will benefit from it. So there are some real big, big problems that we're facing. And I think some of the problems are that we never really treated seriously not only the definition, but also the mechanism. In spite of the wonderful new mechanisms for funding, I think things are still very much centralized, especially by government policy. I remember being at a UNAIDS meeting and one government minister from a country I won't name came up to me and said, well, you know, we've got the money in place, we've got the medicines, but our people aren't coming for them. And I had just been in his country, and I said, well, maybe it's because you're insisting that you distribute this medicine only through the government hospitals, and your government hospitals don't get out to the rural areas. And our church people have to accompany the patients 100 kilometers or 200 kilometers, and they have to pay for the transport because the people don't have the transport money. So you need to decentralize. I think that's something we have to look at for the future. Also, an equitable share of the funding. The Global Fund, and I'm one of the activists that pushes for full funding of the Global Fund, but the Global Fund has given 5.4% of its money to faith-based organizations, when faith-based organizations in sub-Saharan Africa cover 30 to 70% of the healthcare there. There's a disconnect in that kind of flow of money. We need to address that. We need to get the money and the resources to the community groups, including faith-based organizations and many others that are there in the community and then don't leave when some government decides we're not going to fund you anymore. And then I think there needs to be a lot more efficiency in the fund transfers. It's very interesting that the funding schemes and also the bilateral donors insist on monitoring and evaluation, and well, they should, but they insist on that for the local organizations, and yet very often the big money comes into the Ministry of Finance, and it sits there for a very, very long time, and it never gets out to the community groups. And the community groups that don't have the money are expected to advance money to be able to buy the medicines and do the distribution. So there are things that don't work right now in the present system. We need to fight for more money, for continuation of the funding, but also a better and more efficient way of using those funds.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just the one question I want to come back to, maybe ask Dr. Mgeni, and then we'll talk to the people out there. Does universal access make sense to you, Doctor, from a medical point of view? Is there a medical rationale for universal access? I mean, isn't it just okay to treat some people and not treat other people? That's the way we've done things in Africa for a pretty long time. And I mean, you're not a doctor of AIDS, you're a doctor of medicine. So isn't there really a conflict between universal access for people with HIV but not universal access for people with cancer or diabetes in our African countries? Deal with those things, please.
Yeah. Thank you. To answer this question, I'd like to touch on the point by Nicole when she said that the days of the big numbers are gone. I'm sad to hear this statement, because it is big numbers that we have in Africa. We are talking about over 25 million people living with HIV/AIDS in Africa. And if we use the old criteria of 200 CD4 cells, we are talking over 6 million people in need of treatment and not getting it. And if we talk about 350 CD4, we are talking about 15 million people in resource-constrained countries, of which about 13 million are in Africa. So to come and say the days of the big monies are gone, Nicole, is like what we had before in 1990s. Nobody believed that the numbers that could be treated would be treated. And I think this is something that we can right away take off out of our mind. If we cannot afford to treat people, are we going to be able to afford the carnage, the death? These deaths were not people just conking off. These are the people which Reverend Vitilo had talked about. They were filling hospital beds. They were filling under the beds, the corridors. You had to do a ward round stepping over patients lying in the corridors. How much money has been saved? Recently, a journalist came back to one of the hospitals which he had visited before and found some beds empty. And his words was, "I can't believe this is the same bed, this is the same hospital I visited in the 1990s. We are talking about a situation where antiretroviral therapy have almost abolished pediatric AIDS in Europe and developed countries. How much does it cost to treat a child in a lifetime? How much does it cost to raise an HIV-infected child with no mother? What is the economic benefit? So there is a lot of things that we don't measure that are very important. Now, let's look at South Africa. South Africa is no ordinary African country. Its economy alone is almost equivalent to the entire economy of the sub-Saharan Africa. Just one country. Right from the beginning, there was never any question of South Africa not being able to afford antiretroviral therapy. They had the most incredible denialist government and a minister who kept telling people to take beetroots. Now, we had a minister here from South Africa. Almost overnight, South Africa is talking the opposite language to a previous minister. The previous minister used to say, this treatment is not affordable by South Africa. Years later, we have a minister who is saying it is affordable. But what he's actually not mentioning is that that wait between the first minister and the current minister made AIDS treatment, according to economists, 4 to 5 times more expensive than it would have been if it had been treated earlier. So South Africa, right from the beginning, could have treated AIDS. But I agree with Nicole that we need to be smarter. This is not a contradiction to remaining committed to universal access. We need to be smarter. Africa is not a continent which must depend on donors forever. This is something that we reject. But we have an emergency in our midst. We don't want this emergency to last forever. But we need to be helped as we help ourselves to fight not only HIV/AIDS, as we increase our economic capacity to be able to take on more and more. An example is my country, which is now able to treat more people. Recently, they added on 90 million, they are committed to about $90 million in addition, which they would not have afforded if we didn't get a relief of treating the huge number of people who are literally bringing the entire country to a standstill. So there are broader issues on this than merely saying it is expensive. It becomes much more expensive if you don't tackle this very catastrophic situation.
Thanks, Dr. Mugeni. I think, I know Kieran wants to say something, but I think perhaps as we've got a little bit of a debate going here between the doctor and the economist, I should let Nicolae quickly respond. Don't take too long, because I also want to hear from out here in a second, and then I'll ask Kieran.
Just to clarify, what I was trying to say about the days of the big numbers are over, what I meant was the day when we would be mobilizing at a conference for, you know, get an extra $7.5 billion for global AIDS, that discourse seems to be gone. And it's a discourse much more about we all need to work smarter. And then UNAIDS is now actually differentiating between different kinds of countries. And actually, Africa is regarded as the place that still needs lots of support. So I'm in agreement with you. What I just find really interesting is that the UNAIDS' new approach, which is to say, let's see, how big is your economy and how many HIV-positive people have you got? So in the case of South Africa, we've got a big economy. But UNAIDS says because South Africa's got the highest number of HIV-positive people in the world, South Africa still needs support. So UNAIDS calculates we need about $3 billion a year. We get about $1 billion from the government of money, of dollars. We get another $1 billion from America. And according to UNAIDS, South Africa's government needs to put in another half a billion, and we need to get another half a billion from elsewhere. So even South Africa is seen as deserving, even though it's a huge economy, precisely because it's got so many people. Now, they apply this formula right across all countries and come up with which ones are more deserving. So you really should take a look on page 60 and have a look at that, at which ones they're seeing. They're red and green. The other point, though, which I'm trying to make about national political activism, is that there's a lot of criticism out there in the advanced capitalist countries about foreign aid and aid for health. And the foreign aid question goes like this. Why are we protecting foreign aid budgets when everything else is being cut? When we know that when you give a $1 of foreign aid to any country, they actually move the money in effect to other areas. And they also point out they do this in health. So there's a study in The Lancet which shows if you want to get a dollar into the health system in Africa, you have to give an African government $1.5. Because what's happening is, effectively, they cut what they were going to put into health themselves and they move it to education. Now, that's normal politics. And the only way that you can get that full $1.50 into health would be if people in the country say, no, we want it all there. And Aaron Motsoaledi said this morning, he said, universal access requires universal support. And that's really important. If we don't have people on the ground pushing governments for it the whole time, that money will get lost into other causes. And you will get resistance from people in the advanced capitalist countries about giving extra money for health and aid.
Thanks, Nikki. So what you're saying is it's not an argument against universal access.
No.
What you're saying is that we need greater citizen, civil society activism at national level to hold governments accountable for the money that they receive and the money that they spend, but also greater activism at a local level to continue to insist on developed country support to developing countries, because there's no way that developing countries like Malawi or Zimbabwe or other countries can meet the need, the financial, or Uganda, the financial cost. You have to remember that we live in a world where Africa was raped and plundered and set back by colonialism and by neo-colonialism and by structural adjustment, etc. So these are all things that we have to throw into the pot. Kieran, just say a few things, because then it's time that we get other opinions.
Yeah, I just wanted to disagree and agree with Nick Lee. I think the issue of big numbers, and we're not calling for this. I mean, the opening, the demonstration was about those big numbers. If you heard, part of the call was minimum of $20 billion for the global fund. That was just one call, and we know $20 billion isn't even enough, given the new WHO guidelines around early initiation of treatment. So even the big numbers we're asking for isn't even universal access, but it's out there and we're calling for it. And you reference UNAIDS, and I think that they haven't in this report got the costings. That's a failure. Really, you know, what was going on? They just didn't do it. It's a new strategy. They just didn't do it. And I know they will probably admit, oh yes, we should have done this. So I don't think it's a change in the approach. And it is something that we need to push for, that global money, because it does exist, it is there, and I appreciate it's a different environment, but it doesn't stop us asking and pushing. But I do agree with both you, yourself and Mark's next comments. Our African activists are out there, our Asian activists are out there, our Eastern Europeans, you should see it here. They're talking about, for example, the Global Fund should remain global. The Argentinians, the Eastern Europe, the Russians, the Ukrainians are saying, we still need the resources. Our governments aren't doing it. We need resources at the country level so we can do our activism to hold them to account. You see the ERASA campaigns, and Paula, one of the opening plenaries, was talking about that. We are needing to push and get activists on the streets in developing countries. They want to do that. They don't necessarily have the resources. But it also has to be tied to this global ask. And it's this false dichotomy that we always get into these arguments over. It just, you know, we need to do both.
Thanks, Kieran. Let me stand up because I can't see. Is there anybody out there who wants to now make a comment or a short contribution Do you agree with universal access? Do you think it's a bunch of what? How are we going to resolve these conundrums? We've got four activists here who, to some extent, can't even be on the same page at this level. How are we going to win? We all agree on universal access, but we've got some homework to do if we're going to win this battle. And it's a battle that's not an academic battle. It's a battle that, at this moment in time, is about 10 million lives. So we've got to do a little bit better. Can I just see... we'll start off at microphone one, then we'll go to microphone four, then two, then three. So microphone one, please. Questions and comments, but not 10 minutes. Thank you.
Very good. David Bangsberg from Harvard Medical School and Mass General Hospital. Thank you for your comments, Dr. Mugeni. I remember visiting your country when people were dying waiting for treatment in 2000 pre-PEPFAR. Now the treatment is scaled up with the help of PEPFAR and the Global Fund. Most people know the benefits of treatment. How do you think the people in your country will respond if wait lists return and people die waiting for treatment?
Thank you. I'm going to ask the panelists to just note these questions, and we'll come back to them in a minute. At microphone four, please.
Debbie DeVoe with the Ecumenical Advocacy Alliance. I just am curious if someone can answer the question you've asked of why universal access is clear for HIV needs, but not for malaria, cancer, other medical issues.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We must certainly answer that question, panelists. Number two.
Edward Schreiber from UCT, but I'd like to actually speak as an activist more than an academic. And what I think is that there was a particular set of historical and political circumstances which allowed us to win the battle on global funding for HIV/AIDS, or to win a temporary victory. But those circumstances have changed, and what I'm not hearing enough of is activists analyzing where they can bring pressure to bear that will have results. It won't help to scream harder and harder and to say, but this is a moral imperative. How can you go back on the commitments that we've made? That won't change the minds of policymakers who respond to a set of incentives, structural incentives that are brought to bear on them. So I'd like to hear from anyone on the panel who'd like to reflect on that, where we can find the points where we can influence this.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go to number three and then to number nine.
Okay. A couple of quick points. First of all, the Global Fund released a statement a few weeks ago in which they said that they need $17 to $20 billion over 3 years. I might not have my numbers exactly right, but I think that's about it. And so we've got to ask, how do we get that money? It means putting more pressure, not just on Obama, as has been happening at this Congress, but at this conference, but on the U.S. Congress, to try and explain to U.S. voters why it's important to fund AIDS and why it's important to fund healthcare. But not just the U.S., the European Union, Japan, and other countries like China. China's becoming a huge world player. It should be contributing substantially to the Global Fund, and we should be putting pressure on the Chinese government to do that. And then most importantly, from an African point of view, is we have to start getting our own governments to meet their budget commitments, to start committing 15% of their budgets to healthcare. And I just have to take Kieran up on one point, because I'm not as optimistic about activism as he is. I look around and I see a lot of an activist bureaucracy that's developed, where activists look to which conference they're going to hop to next. Where were the activists protesting in Uganda when Global Fund money was stolen a few months ago? When a Malawian man and his transgender partner were arrested, why were the protests in Cape Town and Joburg? Where were the protests in Malawi? And the same thing with Zambia, with Global Fund money that was misappropriated there. We've got to get activists in Africa and activists who come to this conference to start mobilizing on the ground, organizing people in communities to start taking on the wrongs that their governments are committing.
Thank you very much. Number nine.
Good afternoon. My name is George. I'm from Brazil, São Paulo. Well, I wanted to test some experience we had. In 1996, our health authorities wouldn't want to buy triple therapy for us. And Secretary of Health told us, well, you have to give vaccines to little children. If I give money to you, they won't have money for the children, they won't get their vaccines. That is what they told us. And we said, if you have money, because Brazil was doing a kind of supporting many banks which were bankrupted and corrupted, and they were putting lots of money on that. As you say, if you have money for the health of the banks, you should have money for the health of Brazilians. And I think that now it's exactly the same. You have trillions of dollars and euros for the banks, corrupted, bankrupted, and you don't have billions to treat people all over the world. I think that we have to take advantage of this situation, showing that all that money that has arisen, trillions, not billions, for this all of a sudden situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Number three.
My name is Paul Kaur, and I come from Lesotho. I followed with interest the historical background that Dr. Mgenyi gave us. And I remember I was reminded of one of those milestones which were given by the World Health Organization, which was a 3x5 diameter, which determined how many people we were to treat in a certain given time. This was one of the milestones which helped us make progress in providing a treatment for our people. As the panelists talk about whether we can achieve universal access, for some of us it looks like we have no alternative. We have to achieve universal access. It is the only way we can hope to save our nations, and probably the only way we can save the world. But even as we talk about the finances that we need to treat those multitudes of people with treatment, one of the big questions that we are faced with is that of the human resource, which we need to treat the multitudes of people that we need to treat. I would be interested to find out what the panelists feel is the best way, or is the approach that we can make towards accessing human resource for health, because that is an area that we need. It seems to me, in as much as we need the finances, we need that human resource. Is there a way that they can help us out in accessing this so that we achieve universal access, which is a must for us? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to go to number six, and then to number eight, and then we're going to go back to the... I think there's two people at number eight, and then back to the panelists. Number six microphone.
My name's Matthew Wilhelm Solomon from Johannesburg. I'd just firstly like to quickly agree with the colleague there who spoke about holding local health systems to account. When I was in Uganda in 2006, they were burning expired antiretrovirals in the medical health stores at the same time as their stockouts in rural health centres. And these types of things passed without comment, whereas they should have created outrage. But I want to ask the panellists if the whole universal access agenda, where we've really been pushing AIDS, if they view this as a Trojan horse in which we can get other health issues through, or if the activist community hasn't, in a sense, done itself a disservice, where now PEPFAR and the public health establishment is going, well, there's a disproportionate money going into AIDS compared to maternal health or cardiovascular diseases or all these other things. And do not think, in a sense, we've been complicit in creating these disproportion, or is now the space to universalize the movement?
Thank you very much. Before we proceed, I just want to say that because of time, we're now going to have to... I'll take the people who are standing at the microphones, which is four people that I can see, but after that, we'll have to go back to the panelists. So starting with number 8, 8A followed by 8B, and then number two, and then number six, and that will have to be the limit. Thanks.
Hi, Sama Ainan, a youth activist and a medical student about to graduate in an African country. However, I feel it is morally wrong to ask anyone or any country for funding if we don't do it ourselves. How many African countries have adhered to the Abuja Declaration? Do I feel it's global responsibility for HIV/AIDS? There should be priority for healthcare nationally before we ask for more funding. So the people we're supposed to make noise at is not the global fund, but our countries first.
Thank you very much. The second person at microphone 8.
Thanks. My name's Murray Joseph, and I'm from Canada. I just want to reference some of the dialogue and links that Bill Clinton and others have made between broader health and specifically maternal health and treatment in the context of HIV/AIDS, and specifically how unacceptable it is and how much I think we need to hold our governments accountable when people like Canada's Prime Minister, embarrassingly enough, put forward maternal health dollars with restrictions that keep that money from being available for the full spectrum of needs, and that will have a direct impact on treatment and the kind of conversations that we're having today. That's the kind of thing that we need to be acting out against and calling for change on.
Thank you. Thank you. Microphone number 2.
Yes, Joanna Bergen from Canada. Just a reminder that this last year, Canada managed to find enough money to create a vaccine for the H1N1 virus that I believe covered 25 million people, of which most people did not go for the vaccine. And then they proceeded to try to send this vaccine, which has it hasn't been tested over a long period of time, to developing countries to try and recoup some of their losses. I think we need to remember that the G8 countries aren't benevolent countries, that they take far more out of Africa in terms of resources and wealth than they put in terms of aid. And so we do need to keep demanding the countries, I'm from Canada, that they need to be morally accountable for how they talk and the action and the resources that they take out as neocolonialists and what they say they're putting back in.
Thank you very much. The last speaker.
I'm Gassim Umala from Sierra Leone. The issue about the United Nations AIDS, the professor was referring to, normally I've implemented for UN agencies in my country, and normally if they don't have enough funding, they always assign the same to the funding they have, they go down back and cut down on the activities. So let's not make a lot of reference to it. And in our countries, and I happen to come from a least developed country in the world, according to the UNDP 2009 Human Development Index report. But we can put pressure on our government back home, but we also need the support of other people outside the country to also help us to put pressure on our government. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just before I return to the panelists, I'd just like to ask a question. Is there anybody out there who disagrees with universal access? As far as we understand it, does anybody there? Can you put your hand up if you disagree? Does everybody? Let me put it another way. Do you all agree? Yes. Are we sure? I think it's quite important that we know that we all agree, because if we agree, then it's something that we're going to have to fight for. And I want to be able to convey that agreement to the next session, that we're unified in the view that people have a right to access appropriate medical treatment. We've heard your questions. Let's go back to the panelists now, starting with Dr. Mugeni. What are some of your responses? And because time is short, I'm going to ask you to be 3 minutes or so each.
First of all, I want to express my admiration for the quality of the questions and also for the comments. They have been really wonderful and to the point. This is very reassuring to me, because to this audience, It looks like we are talking more or less the same language. So very briefly, thanks, David, for your question about people who have been accessing treatment, for example, in Uganda, and now suddenly some of them are being turned away. In answer to that question, and it was raised earlier, I would say a situation where some of the people, and in some cases from the same family, some of the people accessing treatment while others are not accessing treatment. For example, a father is accessing treatment, but now there is shortage of funds and the mother is not accessing treatment. That kind of situation is a recipe for chaos and danger. This is not just scary statement. These are scientific statements, because we found out recently that a habit that had died out of patients trying to share drugs was creeping back. There is no African mother who would take a drug when her teenage daughter cannot access treatment. So they inevitably started sharing out. This sort of situation leads to resistance. And we have scientific evidence to show that you cannot have adherence when drugs are not accessible. And if you don't have adherence, scientific evidence shows resistance is going to occur. So that others can answer another questions, perhaps I should touch on one very important question that was raised. Is it only AIDS? What about malaria? What about TB? What about diarrheal diseases? What about this? The answer to that is not to say we should take money from AIDS and put it to those other conditions. The answer to that is that we need increased funding for health. Now, just to elaborate a little bit, AIDS is a security issue. It has been one of the programs, the AIDS treatment on the other hand, PEPFAR, has been one of the programs that in my country, Uganda, I would describe as the most successful as strengthening health systems. In my program, we do not have a project that treats only AIDS patients. We have tried to use PEPFAR funds, for example, in my program, to retain healthcare providers, like my colleague from Lesotho pointed out. And we have had increased health workers returning to the profession. They couldn't stay there because they had no drugs to give patients. We have also had, it has brought some facilities like treatment of opportunistic infection and malaria that treats other diseases. It's not enough, but we can build on the achievements to make it not only entire an AIDS program and make sure that the strength that we build within our system is available to tackle other programs as we look for funds from our own resources and donors to increase the care. Perhaps just one thing. There is a hint keep coming about corrupt politicians stealing drugs, stealing donor money, and so on. This is intolerable. All countries should always prosecute people who do that. But one thing we should not do when politicians steal donor money, we should not punish the patients.
Thank you very much. Father Vitila, your thoughts?
I'd like to address the issue also that Becky Johnson and some of the other questioners raised about why universal access just for HIV and not for other illnesses. I think that we have within our view and our objectives for universal access to development that all of the issues should be included. And I know that many of the activists around the TB world are learning a great deal from HIV activists and are now trying to implement that in their own activism. I think we have to eliminate the vertical programming, but also I think we need to challenge ourselves as activists to eliminate the vertical advocacy that we do as well, sometimes against other groups that are working on issues that are very, very similar. So I think we need to join our hands and forces if we really want to address some of the major structural health and development problems in the world.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Nikki.
This notion that we've given billions and billions to the banks, why can't we give it to people with health for health reasons? I mean, I think that we've really got to understand how many billions we have given to the banks, and we've just given billions, well, not us, but the OECD has given as much money to Greece in the last month or two as we gave to the US banks. The result of this is a debt burden that's unprecedented. We've not seen debt-to-GDP ratios like this ever. And to just carry along as if we are blind to this economic crisis around us, I just think is just bad politics. I mean, it's, and I think that is an important point, because look at the UK. They've been told, cut, prepare budgets that are 40% lower on social security, on everything, but we're going to ring-fence health and we're going to ring-fence foreign aid. President Obama is doing the same thing. He hasn't got 40% cuts, but he's protecting health and he's protecting foreign aid. We are lucky that they are both, these countries are protecting foreign aid, and health is pushed to the top of the agenda. Now, for us to start demanding more money on top of that, I think is incredibly dangerous, because the danger we run as activists is we're going to lose the moral authority. Now, one of the big voices for the backlash comes from a man called Mead Over from Washington, Center for Global Development. And he's done a calculation, one of these big number calculations. And he says, wow, if we push everybody needs to be on treatment, 95% coverage, by 2016, he says, half of all of the U.S. foreign aid in total will go on antiretrovirals. And he sits back and he says, isn't that ridiculous? And it is ridiculous. You're not going to get anybody out there, I don't even think in this room, who thinks that half of U.S. foreign aid should go on treatment. Let's forget about prevention and everything else. So at some level, there's a reasonableness quotient. We've got to take people with us when we argue for treatment, which is why it's really important to go for this treatment 2.0, as UNAIDS has called it, to go much smarter. And we also need to go back to this question, why AIDS and not malaria and all these other things. Very, very important question, and that's back to Motsoaledi's point about universal access needs universal support. Every activist in the country needs to say, we need to work smarter and better, we need to have nurses driving our programs, and we need to build our primary healthcare facilities. We need to get national health insurance. We want to develop health, and we're going to use AIDS as the cutting edge. That way you build alliances, you get people thinking, oh, this is for us, not just for them. Don't get up and say, we want more, when everybody else is suffering. That's dangerous, bad politics, and that really worries me, which is why I don't like the politics of the big number. And I suspect that UNAIDS deliberately left it out. We can differ. Maybe they just didn't calculate it, but I think there's a good strategy. And finally, on the Abuja Declaration, why have the African governments moved away from 15% on health? It's because they can get away with it. Why is that? Because their populations aren't necessarily wanting to hold the governments to 15% of the budget on health. So that again means if you really want that argument, you've got to build grassroots support, make alliances, and get people to understand why 15% on health. To demand that it comes from outside and it gets imposed on African governments is another form of colonialism. So be very careful of that. You've really got to balance the kind of national building up of grassroots activism with support rather than dictation from the national community.
Thank you, Nikki. I wish we had another half an hour to deconstruct your arguments, which I disagree with personally. And I think we must be very careful about people who throw out scare figures, very large figures that may be unsubstantiated, and also people who contrast debt relief needs with the social and human rights needs of the most vulnerable populations of the world. To fund universal access would not break the global bank. Funding universal access might cost a few tens of billions of dollars, which is small change
compared to the trillions and the hundreds of billions that are put into the world economy. But these are clearly issues that we have to look at, because they're clearly arguments that are out there. And if we don't win those arguments and combine those arguments with our own arguments, then we're not going to make the necessary advances. Kiran, you're from ICASO, you're an activist. Tell us what you think.
Yeah, and I completely agree with what you've said, and I think that's part of the story. And I think, to a large extent, I think we agree. Again, it's not this dichotomy. We agree that we have to have governments and we have to have activists working at the country level to stop the corruption, to get the investment in health, to get the 15%. You know, that has to happen, as well as saying, yes, we can get that money, but it can't be one or the other. It has to be both. So I think there's agreement there. I do want to answer, there were some questions around activists and whether we've got to rethink how we're doing it and are we understanding how we're working. And I think that's a good question. And I think in these discussions over this week, we're constantly having it as activists. And we're going through this week really trying to work some of this out. But I think, for example, Bill Clinton, was it yesterday, saying that the activists were wrong to demonstrate against Obama. They got it wrong. That wasn't the way to do it. And I think it was really unfair, because the activists knew what they were doing. Part of it is to get, you know, the take the people with us, I think Nikki said. It's to get that attention, the general public. But it's also to work with Congress. It is to work with the policymakers. Peter goes and talks to Congress and others and says, you know, this is what's happening in Uganda. And that's matched with the activism in country. You know, somebody asked, I think, where are the activists? Are we just coming to the conferences? I can tell you, most activists hate conferences. And actually, when you say, where are the activists? You see them in Zimbabwe. The gay and lesbian organization in Zimbabwe speaking out, having its offices closed down, having to leave the country, and still speaking out. And if go back to the country, in serious danger. Happening in Jamaica, they're out on the streets. So the activism is there, and it's not always so apparent to us when we come to the conferences. But part of it is, we had a conversation yesterday with a number of community leaders from different key populations, from women and girls, from sex workers, the people who use drugs, etc. And one of the things we were saying is, like, what are our strategies now? And interestingly, nearly everyone talked about us working together. Now, this was within the HIV community, but also the sexual and reproductive health and maternal child health. And I think there's a real understanding that we have to reach out beyond that and call for greater funding for health, greater funding for education, greater fund. It's the bigger pie, and it sort of sits uncomfortably with some of Nikki's analysis of, you can't ask for those big figures. But we can only join together if we're all going out there and saying, actually, international development needs to be there. Governments at the national level need to be funding this. So I think we do need to work it out. I don't think we all have the solutions. But I would say one last thing, and that's in terms of, you asked me at the beginning and then you didn't let me answer it, in terms of, is it too late to define universal access? And I don't think it's about the language and what's on paper. We know what works, and we know that, you know, in Ukraine, people who use drugs need access to certain services, opiate substitution therapy, etc. We know what's needed. Just do that. You know, and we can be asking, for example, UNAIDS as technical advisors to go to country and push and say, hey, this is what technically in your epidemic is what you could and should be doing. A country process will work out, you know, are these the appropriate targets? How do we achieve that? Where do our resources go? What external resources do we need? And having that financial strategy that says, this is how we pay for it. But I think that all needs to go together with, you know, but finding new ways of doing it, because we are in a crisis, as it were. Thank you.
Thank you, Kiran. I've just been asked to sum up what I think are the conclusions of this session in 3 minutes before, in order to help the next session on the future of universal access. So let me try and do that very, very briefly. My sense is that the starting point is that everybody in this room
agrees that universal access is a necessity when it comes to HIV, AIDS, and TB. And not only that universal access is a necessity when it comes to HIV, AIDS, and TB, but as a matter of principle, that people in this world should have universal access to necessary healthcare services. And that what we have done by pioneering and reviving the concept of universal access in relation to HIV is to cut a path and to re-establish a set of principles that should apply to all causes of disease, to all necessary treatments. So what we are saying here is that the bar should be raised in relation to all health conditions, not once more pulled back down again so that HIV can be equated with the neglect of other diseases and other conditions. That is what we're saying in relation to universal access. There seems to be a little bit of dispute on the economics of health, but certainly some of us in this room believe that if health is defined as a human right, and even Clinton yesterday used the word health as a right without perhaps understanding what he meant by health as a human right. But if health is a human right, then there are state duties and obligations to meet that human right. States accept other duties and other obligations. Something that is fundamental to life, like health, should also be accepted as a human right. I'd ask the next group to work on that basis. I think in this discussion, although we've said that there were problems, that we left holes in the road when Kieran and others negotiated for universal access, that perhaps we should have developed a better definition of what we meant by universal access, there seems to be no doubt that the notion of universal access has been an important and a beneficial notion, because universal access has created the ambition that has driven investment into HIV and AIDS for at least half a decade. And universal access as a principle has saved many, many lives. Universal access has brought about advances, and as Dr. Mugyeni said, universal access has strengthened health systems. Universal access has brought demoralized healthcare workers back into the health system because they are able to practice medicine. But therefore, the danger of giving up on universal access is not just the danger of giving up on a vision, it's the danger that once you give up on that vision, the drivers that mobilize people behind those vision start to fall away. And the world starts operating on a country-by-country basis, on my resources versus your resources basis again. And then we're back in a mess on HIV. And we're not just back in a mess on HIV, we're back in a mess on tuberculosis, we're back on a mess on infant mortality, we will see rising maternal mortality. And some principles that we've won with HIV for all people will be lost for all people if we don't succeed. So we say to the next group, I believe, that we believe in universal access as a human right. But clearly, when you come to talk about the future of universal access, you have to help with strategies to answer the political objections to universal access, even though those political objections are ill-founded. And you have to come with strategies to answer the economic objections to universal access, even though I believe the economic arguments are ill-founded and unjustified. So as you talk about, or as we talk about, the future of universal access, those are some of the issues I believe that need to be on the table and that need to be considered. So thank you very much, everybody, for participating in this session. I hope that you are marathon runners and you can stay for another hour and a half after a cup of tea, because these are important questions, as Dr. Mugyeni and Father Vitilo and Nikki and Kieran will say. Lives are at stake, rest in some respects on this discussion. Could I just say that this discussion will also be continuing throughout the conference. For example, there's a session tomorrow night at 6:30 in session room 4.
that is being organized by La Caso, the Latin American Council of AIDS Service Organizations, that will debate this issue. So let's try and nail this down. Let's try and put this issue to bed in Vienna 2010 so that we can pass the nonsense and get on with the real business of promoting health as a human right. Thank you very much for your time and attention. Thank you.